This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Let's go back.
I think we did something to him.
So no one knows we're here.
No.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. This week, we'll be taking a look at 2014's Exists, a fantastic, furry, probably smelly romp into the world of Bigfoot. I am your host, Adam Hasek, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Not joined this week by Sam, who has taken a bit of a holiday down to Australia, though coincidentally, the sightings of the Yowie, aka Australia's Bigfoot, have gone up recently in the last couple weeks, so make it that way you may. Joining me, as always, is the Baroness, Libby Young, writer at Short Story Soup, and, as always, we have Dave, our vet and physiologist. How's it going?
I have an immediate question. Since we're doing yes. Bigfoot this week, who is the hairiest member of our podcast?
Probably me.
Yeah, probably Adam. Sorry, Libby. Your poor shower drain.
It's actually very true.
Exactly. Oh, I forgot to add up top. This week, we'll be, there'll be time to go to the bottom to skip ahead any segments you want to look at. We'll be talking about the evolution and ecology of Bigfoot as a species, active camouflage as a subject, and then Libby will be taking us through Squatch culture. But before we get into the science, do we have any news? Mine's very unfortunate, and it has to do with the flurry of very poor and some would say heinous decisions made by the United States Supreme Court, basically taking away the power of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to regulate big companies and the enormous amounts of pollution that they do. So despite fighting and trying to limit these enormous sources of pollution, the Supreme Court said, nope, you can't do that. So fuck you, you're not rich.
On a slightly more positive note, I saw that China is starting to ban single-use plastics.
Which would be huge.
California is making a move to ban certain single-use plastics, and Canada has, in terms of we've had a ban that went into effect over the last month. I will say that I really enjoy all of my cucumbers now come wrapped in a cardboard label that says biodegradable. And just says compostable, and I don't have to worry about my cucumbers being covered in that shitty plastic anymore if I get it from the grocery store.
Lovely.
Your cucumbers were individually wrapped in plastic?
Every single one. Could not find them in Jesus. Any other way, shape, and or form. So wrap me in plastic
and make me shine. This week we are covering the movie Exists, which is about a disheveled yet happy hermit who makes an ill-fated decision on a night to take their only child on a moonlit walk. Tragedy strikes, literally, as the child is killed in a hit-and-run by a group of remorseless assbags. The grief-stricken recluse watches as the murderous crew parties the next day, drinking, toking, and fucking, all while their child grows colder by the hour in its fresh grave. Like a hairy version of Liam Neeson, the hermit decides it's time to find them. And kill them. I can't do a low voice, sorry. One by one, their revenge is exacted on the child killers. One by one, the John Wick of the woods lines up the dead bodies of the heartless horrors by the child they've so callously slain. All but one. One man who seems to finally understand their pain. One man who shows his heart and possibly changes theirs, leaving behind perhaps a survivor, or perhaps a reminder.
Or Bigfoot turned around 3 seconds later and ripped the guy's head off.
Also, didn't we already do this movie? This was Pumpkinhead.
That's what I thought as I was writing the summary. I was like, oh, this is Pumpkinhead.
Right. It was just like, it was a slightly hairier Ed Harley.
Ed Harley. What did you like about this movie, Dave?
You know what? I will say that the fear aspect of this movie did feel real at a couple of seconds. So the idea of them kind of like turning around in the wilderness and not knowing if you're going to turn around and suddenly Bigfoot's going to be there was good. The bicycle chase scene was fucking terrifying. He keeps looking over and Bigfoot's just moving through the woods at top speed, getting closer and closer to you. And even when he turns around and sees Bigfoot on the road in front of him, that was scary.
That scene was fucking great.
Yep.
Just no, like, it doesn't even, it just seems like one of those scenes where he's just looking for phone signal and nothing's happening. And all of a sudden, like, surprise, bitch, it's time to for a chase. Like, he's right there.
Right. And Bigfoot attacking the cabin in the middle of the night, just like the pounding through the walls, the smashing through the floorboards. There was a good fear element to this that I thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah, I think mine is very similar. I said a few scenes for me had the magic. The bike scene, obviously, like we just said, is incredible. When it jumps off the cliff onto the trailer was also holy fuck. I thought the burrow rescue was pretty good. Like, you just didn't know like what was gonna happen, and it was like a good tense moment. These moments sort of had that movie je ne sais quoi, you know. The practical effects weren't terrible. I don't know what their budget was. And I'll say this about them. It didn't take me out of it, which I feel like is very hard to do for a Bigfoot movie because it's like a guy in a suit. So I give them kudos for that.
Yeah, I think I will definitely agree with Dave and Libby on this. It's the creature looks great on what I can only assume is a very small budget. And it never once took me out. Even the last scene where it's very clearly a man in a suit. The makeup is convincing. Yeah. The personification of this hominid that's not a human was also pretty convincing. And even the full-on daylight, you see the entire creature running after dumbass McDummerson with his gun macho-ness.
I was like, it which one is good. That?
Still, all of them. It's really convincing. It's really fun. And yet, again, just him looking around and the camera panning and Bigfoot standing right there, 20 feet from him, like coming for him. That was really, really cool. And I love found footage. It's a genre of horror that I really, really enjoy. And I think I'm definitely the biggest fan of it on this podcast in particular.
I would say that you are.
Now, Dave, what didn't you like about this movie?
I'm going to leave the comments on character decisions to Libby because I'm sure she is all ramped up for this.
Cracks knuckles.
I'm going to take the biological perspectives. Everything needs to sleep. The idea that Bigfoot attacks them during the night and during the day and during the night and then again during the day. Bigfoot is either the world's greatest cocaine meth addict or there's something else going on.
I said the exact same thing. I was like, does this fucker ever sleep? Right? Just power naps. It's all power naps.
just quick little sleepy sleeps in the middle of the day, just sitting next to the cabin. Oh, they're up again. Two, and I'm sure Adam and Libby can both agree with me on this. Guns suck. Like, just you get hit by a gun, doesn't matter. Like, sepsis will take you very quickly, even if you do survive out there. Pieces of you getting blown off. Things are painful. Things are hurting. This Bigfoot would not be operating at the capacity that it is based on the wounds that we get to see at the end of the film.
Adrenaline can only last you so long.
Or apparently a pound of cocaine and meth.
That's really
shotgun
what it is.
Blast to the face.
Yes.
Like, shotguns are not a joke. This is not a little handgun they shot him. It's a fucking shotgun with buckshot. You saw the hole it took out of the door. That would be the same hole out of Bigfoot's face.
Yes.
Yeah. I just liked pretty much everything else. I felt like the acting was meh. As Dave said, the tropes were dumb. The decision-making was just plot for plot's sake. And I literally hated everyone. Like, why is everyone in this movie a dickbag? The note I put here is, this is like the shittiest friend group ever. You have the start of the film where they're lighting a person's beard on his face on fire while he's sleeping, and they're filming and laughing at it. What the fuck? And then it's like, oh, you feel bad for him because he's like clearly getting picked on. No. He proceeds to like film people having sex without their consent, clearly is creepily filming his friend's girlfriend. And then
his brothers, his
brother,
girlfriend.
That's right.
And the filming, he even says to himself, he's like, I really shouldn't be filming this.
I should stop. And yes, you should.
Filming. Yeah. I felt like there was the scene where, you know, obviously spoiler, the girlfriend's dying in front of him. And the fact that he's just like heavy breathing filming her, it's just, it was so creepy. It was like a continuity of creep. And then they
I just like to imagine he's behind the, I just like to imagine he's behind the camera, like holding with one hand and kind of like, give me more. Come on. Really, I need more for this.
No, he's like pushing on her stomach to make the blood like.
Their giant friend, the guy who lights the fireworks, when he's under the camper and the one guy's just filming from the bed and in fact is moving around on the bed on top of his brother's broken legs to get a better view.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Although I will say, if there's anybody you're going to send off against the Bigfoot, send that dude. He was huge.
Yeah,
he was
enormous. Yeah, but then you like don't help him at all.
Right.
You go and rescue your brother, and then you're like, yeah, that guy, I don't really care that much about him.
I think I agree with him on that one. Like, it already got him. You're not going to be able to help him at this point. The brother was a rescue. This was a joint suicide, I feel like.
Maybe. I feel like, too, though, there's something to be said about this is the largest man that you have to protect you. And, like, if ever you're going to have a shot to, like, try, that might have been it.
Also.
Yeah, fair.
Side note, where did the fire poker go? We clearly see a scene where the older brother's.
There's a fire poker?
The older brother's girlfriend mm-hmm. is holding a metal fire poker in her hand. And then during the entire scene that Bigfoot's trying to get in and attack them, and even when they go out into the wilderness, fire pokers would do the trick. A good old fire poker to the face.
Yep. Iron skewer, baby.
Yep.
Yeah. These people are horrible. And let's just like, even the whole premise of them stealing from their family members, his uncle, and then lying to people and taking away their like rational choice and decision-making ability. It just really reminded me of The Descent, the movie that we covered a few months ago. Oh. Where it's like you lie about the situation and it gets everyone killed.
Yeah, I don't really think I have anything novel to add to those sentiments. These people are reprehensible. I don't even think I can really say anything nice too much about any one of them. They're just a pack of dickbags making dickbag decisions. And it's super unfortunate. Also, you're driving at night in the woods with nothing around. How do you not see a baby Sasquatch walking right towards the fucking Jeep? How do you not see the massive, clearly 6 to 7 foot tall big Sasquatch on the side of the road coming right towards the car in the headlights? It wasn't in the trees. It was on the side of the road. And I'm gonna- Who's got some trivium?
I do. So if anybody recognizes the name Brian Steele, this is a 6'7" actor who played the role of Bigfoot in this movie.
Oh,
okay.
But this is his second time playing Bigfoot. He originally played the much friendlier Harry from Harry and the Hendersons.
Did he?
Wow.
Yes. Which is incredible.
They got Harry.
Reprised his role. Harry's had some hard times.
Good get for this movie.
The Hendersons kicked him out. this is just.
So are these part of this, a shared universe?
Yes, exactly. Brian Steele, like I said, who has reprised his role as Bigfoot, has also played pretty much every big fucker you've seen in sci-fi and horror films, including the Cthulhu and the Relic.
Really?
Yeah. So we have covered him before. He's also been in franchises such as Resident Evil, Underworld, Hellboy, Blade, Predator, Doom, The Lady in the Water, The Minotaur Who Gets His Dick Cut Off, and the underrated classic Your Highness and Terminator.
Wow.
Damn. I feel like it's less trivia, but more, I guess, fun relation to the podcast. The woods this cabin is set in are so very alike to the woods that I grew up around in Alabama, in the southern U.S. So I was really feeling that childhood nostalgia this entire time, minus, you know, the whole being chased by a 6'7" actor in a fursuit trying to kill me. And my friends weren't lighting me on fire.
I think you just miss trees in general.
Get me out of the desert!
Many of these trees were my friends. Creatures I had known from nut and acorn.
All right, before we get into the science, if you want to find Sam and I on Twitter, Sam is at Big Dr. Fishboy, boy spelled B-O-I, because he's a cool kid.
Boy.
I'm at Hessic Adam. You can check out a link to my new paper published in Freshwater Biology.
What, what?
If you want to get in touch with the podcast, send us feedback, recommendations, suggestions. Just tell us what you like, what you don't like. We'll work on it.
Do it.
You can send us an email at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can check out our website, cinematica.animalia.com. If you want to check out some more of the writing that Libby does for the outside of the podcast, you can check out shortstorysoup.substack.com for a hairy handful of hair-raising tales. And if you want to find some of the more hardcore ecology that Sam, myself, and an international team of writers write about, please check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And last but not least, if you want to game with us on Discord, check out our Discord server. The link will be in the show description. Yeah, so for the ecology and evolution of Bigfoot, a.k.a. the Sasquatch, a.k.a. Aussie Yowie, I am going to be taking a lot of inspiration and kind of basis from Max Brooks's Bigfoot book. It's called Devolution, a first-hand account of the Rainier Sasquatch Massacre. If you don't know, Max Brooks is Mel Brooks' son, and he is a prolific author and writer of, you might be more familiar with his primary work, World War Z, which is a book the movie was based on, and it is much, much, much better than the movie. I said that with supreme confidence, having never even seen the movie, so take that for what you will. But in Devolution, Max Brooks posits a theory whereby Bigfoots are, or Sasquatch, are a relatively close relative of humans, another hominid species that would have evolved around the same time as Neanderthals and Homo sapiens and other early anthropoid species. But unlike the somewhat reclusive and occasionally horrific nature you see in Bigfoot movies or culture, these are very dangerous, very strong, very fast predators that specialized, or at least targeted with ruthless abandon, humans in the early days of our civilization and the emergence of our species. One of the theories posited in that book is that the idea is that humans came across the Bering Sea land bridge back when Alaska and Russia or Kamchatka were still connected by a land/ice bridge. And the theory is that we followed prey species across the bridge into North America, and that is how hominids got to North America originally. The book posits that the Bigfoots followed us following the prey herds to get down here and then kept chasing humans. And
we were the prey herd.
Theory about, we were the prey herd, yes. Mm. And a big reason why we are scared of the dark is because that they are a nocturnal species that is very good at hunting and bigger, stronger, and faster than us. So it's not good to be around them. Then the idea being that as humans' technology increased and we got better at hunting and using tools, we were able to maybe not handle them one-on-one, but more effectively defend/take them out. So they kind of retreated away from human society into the more wild spaces of North America and potentially other areas in the world. But from an evolutionary standpoint, I feel like it's not insane to think about the reality of a missing link type species that would look somewhat like a Sasquatch would. I can't really speak for the enormous feet because it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. Maybe Dave, you have more knowledge on that than I do, but it seems inefficient and in the way, unless it was potentially sexually selected, whereby the female Sasquatches or the male Sasquatches really liked partners with big feet.
Why would they like big feet, Adam?
Because they get to wear big shoes, and everyone knows Bigfoots love nothing more than a big shoe. Now, in hominid evolution, the most common one people are probably most familiar with are Neanderthals. And these were a species of hominid that were slightly larger than Homo sapiens are, and they were adapted to live in caves. So they had better low-light vision than we did. At least that's the theory based off of how large their visual cortex was compared to ours. So I don't think it's incredibly unlikely that a Sasquatch would have evolved a very developed visual cortex and potentially superior low-light vision to humans, given them the ability to be very efficient nocturnal hunters, which would also lend, or at least, which would go hand-in-hand with them being hard to discover and not found very often by humans. Although that's an enormous stretch, and it seems incredibly unlikely that we would have never found them by now, that is what I'm going to say and how it, quote, makes sense. So, in the movie, we see this cocaine-addled Bigfoot hunting night and day, left and right, always running, never taking a break. It might be on meth. But I think that this is either a potentially deranged and or diseased individual. And that is why it is away from a social group. Primates are social animals, and I find it very unlikely that this individual would be by itself. But I think that I also have another theory that would lend into why it would be by itself. In the animal kingdom, especially mammals, I can't speak as much for other large and dangerous animals, you have cases where females will try to keep males away from them, especially when they have young, because the males will attempt to kill the young. So that way the female will then be motivated to not only mate with the male, but then have offspring with him, passing his genes on and not his competitors. So potentially this is a female Squatch, and she has her child away from any of the males so they don't kill it and then try to have their own children with her. One theory. Other one being it potentially has some kind of degenerative neurological disease, maybe a prion of some kind from eating, maybe cannibalizing its fellow Squatches or
humans,
eating somebody who was infected with a prion, yeah. Or humans, yeah. And then causing it to behave erratically and differently, which would explain why it's hunting in the nighttime and the daytime, why it seems to be just killing them for killing them's sake. Grief could play into it, and it seems to be a relatively intelligent organism, so it could feel those things potentially.
Its baby died, Adam. All right?
Its baby did die. But I've also seen videos of other animals that will choose to kill one of their babies so the other two can survive, instead of fighting really hard to keep them alive. So it's a sliding scale.
Yeah, there's plenty of animals that have been shown to have grief and even like, you know, yep. quote funerals for their dead.
For sure. And my understanding of that, and I could be wrong, is that that is usually more apparent among organisms that have a higher intelligence quota than others do.
And produce fewer right. offspring.
Yes. It is what we call the type 1 a K-selected species, which is reaching a carrying capacity, and they have fewer, more resources devoted to offspring than an R-selected species, like an insect, which just has tons of babies. Most of them will die, but some of them will reproduce.
Now, Adam, from an ecologist perspective, having single Bigfoots out wandering the wilderness away from one another makes total sense from a population dynamics. There'd be no risk of inbreeding with a small population or serious problems with like finding a partner to mate, right? Secondary to habitat fragmentation. These things wouldn't be an issue, right? You don't see this being a problem with Bigfoot?
Definitely not at all, especially not with humans developing more and more and more of these wild spaces and making them more and more fragmented. It would be a huge issue, and I think that is what lend into my hypothesis about it being some kind of outcast slash maybe even the last of its kind in that area. If you have small populations, you run a huge risk of, as Dave said, having inbreeding, and where you have an inbreeding depression whereby related individuals are mating with one another. There is less and less genetic diversity within the population as a whole, which makes them more vulnerable to diseases and infections, because when you have inbreeding like that, there's a higher chance of these so-called recessive traits coming to light. Usually you have two kinds of genes. Dominant.
I was about to say, see any royal family line.
Yep.
Exactly. See all of the royal family line, because they're all anemic, because they're all inbred fucks. Now, a very, very basic overview of the genetics behind this is you have dominant and recessive genes. The dominant gene is dominant to the recessive. If there's one copy of a dominant when there's supposed to be two, it will override the recessive and show the dominant trait. You need to have two recessives.
Does the submissive or the recessive gene have a safe word for the dominant gene?
They enjoy, you know, the submitting to the dominance, but the recessives are probably more reclusive in nature, I would say.
The safe word is first cousin.
Safe word's chromosome.
Then all the Bigfoot would be saying its safe word all the time, because
it probably would.
I was amazed at the amount of proper groups like National Geographic or even Science that had dug into this debate to give all the reasons why Bigfoot can't exist. And the best reason I saw is they were going through all these different reasons about genetics and altered sequences and population dynamics. But then they just had, it was like a master's or a PhD student at like some university whose top comment was, "We have cars and hunters, guys. All right. Somebody would have run this over or shot one of these things by now if they were out there." And I was like, yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, things wander onto highways and cars are fast. We hit each other all the time with bullets and cars. we would definitely hit one of these.
The only way this would have made sense is if there was literally one individual left in the 1950s or whenever, when the first like fake film came out of a Bigfoot. And so people spent a lot of time trying to look for this one organism, which in an enormous swath of wilderness is going to be very hard to find one individual. But if there's an actual population, you're probably going to find them.
Yeah. And Adam, you can confirm, you know, there's quote, new species discovered all the time, but the vast majority of those are small insectoids, itty bitty protozoa type critters.
Small, you know, arthropods, spiders, insects, other insects like beetles, might have plants. New species could be, quote, discovered because one species they thought was a single species turned out to be exactly. Two different ones.
That's what I was just going to say.
A lot of these are cryptic.
A lot of the species that they discover too are just slight variations of ones that we've seen.
Right. Where a biologist sits down and they go, well, with new genetics, we know that this butterfly is in fact black and orange, but this other butterfly is orange and black. Completely different.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, finding new species every day is not finding a Squatch every day.
Casey, I don't want to blow smoke up your butt here, but I think you found a new species.
Yeah, right.
Hey, it could happen. New species are discovered every day.
So the section I just wanted to talk about while watching this, because I was thinking about this is the most terrifying aspect of the forest, is the idea behind camouflage. And the woods, for anyone who regularly goes out there or goes jogging, can be really terrifying, the way that things can blend between the trees. As a teenager, so my parents have a large chunk of approximately 100 acres of forest attached to their house. And I used to really enjoy going for long jogs through the woods up until I saw the Blair Witch Project. And then for at least a year, every time I would jog through a certain area of the woods, my eyes would flirt over and any movement of a leaf or anything like that, my brain would immediately say, it's the Blair Witch, you're fucking dead. And man, did I learn to run fast.
I like how you said flirt over, and I thought you were saying you were like giving the Blair Witch your like googly eyes.
No, hey, then she'd kill me faster. That wouldn't get me out of it. Did you not watch the movie at all?
She needs love too.
It's a different interpretation.
Of course I watched the movie. Yeah, it definitely wasn't the porn parody.
I was about to say.
Same directors exist, it turns out.
Oh. So when it comes to active camouflage, there's a couple of different mechanisms by which camouflage can be undertaken. And I'm not going to go into the detailed things like this podcast's resident animal, the cuttlefish, with the chromatophores, as Sam would say, womp, womp, womp.
Cuttlefish.
Womp, cuttlefish.
Womp, womp, womp. Cuttlefish.
Instead, I'm just going to be talking about basic ideas behind alterations of natural physical structures and alterations of color. So the word which I thought was absolutely fantastic, which relates to camouflage that's associated with coloration, is simply known as cryptic coloration. Coloration that decreases the risk of being detected. In most species, this is fur, but it also can take place with skin or plates or scales.
Is this different from crypt keeper coloration?
What does the crypt keeper coloration look like? Is that sitting in a basement and
dusty,
filming your show over and over and over again?
I think the color aesthetic of the crypt keeper is dust.
Yeah, yeah. And cackling laughter.
Yes.
When this takes place, there's a couple of different ways this works, and I'm not going to be able to explain all of these different terms, but I am going to throw out some really cool concepts that I got to learn researching this. So the brain needs to do a huge amount of work when it comes to visual processing. The light that strikes your retina, the area associated with the back of your eye, and then transmits it to the brain, guess what percentage of information moves from the retina up the optic nerve? So of the light that's absorbed, what percentage of that information actually moves to the brain for further processing?
17.
I'm going to guess a very small percentage. I'm going to go with 7%.
So Libby is closest. 1% of that information actually moves up the optic nerve.
I was going to say 2, but I thought it was too low.
That's insane. So of that, that information, once it reaches the brain, is also still too much. And there's a huge amount of processing that needs to basically be undertaken in order to take all that information down and use it effectively. This is apparently a really interesting area that's currently going on with AI visual training to try and get them to learn things like self-driving cars. Now, there's a couple of different mechanisms that are associated with how we learn to see. And these are things like shapes, contours, being able to separate it out, because it's really important that naturally we are able to see things moving outside of our background. We want to be able to see the predators that are coming, because otherwise they will fucking kill us.
Also the prey we're hunting with our forward-facing eyes.
Right, right. Okay, I mean, I always apparently take the more cowardly approach of something coming to get me. Adam is completely right. I should be thinking more on the predatory basis.
I will never die.
So I think the easiest way to talk about how camouflage works is simply by talking about people that use it the most. Military camouflage in terms of...
The predator. Oh, okay.
So military camouflage is used in a whole set of different ways to trick the brain. And basically, it's used based off natural camouflage, how animals have taken on millions of years of evolution to make alterations in coat that allow them to appear more invisible against their background. So the first thing you want to do is dull hues, right? Dull colors tends to make up our world, right? Unless you are spending all of your time hiding in that cherry blossom tree, generally speaking, if you're trying to camouflage in, you're wanting to take on something more earthy in terms of its tone. Camouflage, contrary to popular belief, can have a single color. But usually it's got several similarly colored patches that are kind of mixed together. The reason for using this sort of pattern is that it creates something called visual disruption. So the meandering lines of molted camouflage help hide contours or the outlines of the body. So when you look at a piece of molted camouflage in a matching environment, your brain naturally connects the lines of the blotted colors, and you basically blend it in with the trees, the grounds, the shadows. The colors are coming at you in such a variety that are kind of all slightly different hues that the visual processing center of the brain just goes, fuck it. No, it's all the same thing. I've got so much information coming in right now. That's a bush. Oh God, the bush is attacking us.
To your point about the single color, one of the things I remember from history classes in high school, for those of you aren't very familiar with the United States Civil War of the 1860 to 1865 variety, the North wore dark blue. And the Confederacy, the ones that people want to celebrate the, quote, heritage and culture of that loser flag, they wore gray uniforms. And one of the enormous advantages that the Confederacy had, from my learning of this, that war itself, was that their gray uniform was very, very hard to see, especially at dawn and dusk. Mm. So it made them excellently camouflaged against the background. It was a nightmare for the Union soldiers.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, in terms of other mechanisms aside from color and aside from that sort of blotching mixed color pattern, angles. So generally speaking, the brain tends to look for straight lines, either horizontal or vertical. Most camouflage is designed in such a way to create kind of a meandering pattern. So it stops the brain from being able to really link on to how that image is moving. And the last thing is continuity. So continuity is the idea that one of the ways we were able to track is by objects or lines that move in the same direction. We're able to look at a human and visually see the outline of their body because we're able to follow the lines that are associated with it. Really good camouflage, both in the natural kingdom and within the military, looks to basically break up that idea of continuity by creating differences that throw your brain off, such that you're not able to basically put that thing together the way that it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. The field of research that's gone into this is fucking extensive, and I barely got buried in some of this last night, but the Royal Society actually has a great summary of all the neuroscience and all the mechanisms that go into this and how we're using this to try and better teach algorithms how to track people.
Yeah, I just wanted to do a quick PSA, though, about color specifically, is if you are hunting, as in a person hunting deer or squirrel or rabbit, what have you, ducks, do not be afraid to wear the color orange because it is safe. It provides a safety net in which humans, because we can see color, will not shoot your face off. But most animals can't see color.
Dick Cheney.
as Dave was saying, the pattern and how we see shapes is primarily the most important thing. Hence why you see tigers. I mean, tigers are fucking orange. but the way that their fur is patterned is their camouflage. It's not the color itself.
And that's an important evolutionary standpoint. They've looked at this in a number of different species. You only evolve coloration changes if it's important because your prey or predator sees color.
Exactly.
Now, in regards to our Bigfoot, he can't be black. Like, he's got to be a slightly different like tone associated with him. Bigfoot, in my eyes, has always been kind of an off brown whenever we've kind of seen him before.
Brown.
This guy stands out so well that we can see him easily when he's running after the bicycle. It's this big moving black object that's running through the woods.
Through the trees, yeah.
Maybe absolutely.
A nocturnal hunter, but he's out too actively during the day.
Even for nocturnal, I feel like there should be some sort of dappling in the coat.
Yeah.
You know, even if nocturnal, like you need to hide in the shadows. And if you're just a pitch black giant shape, that is very easily spotted.
Right. Dark brown would, again, be totally fine for this in terms of the alteration associated with the camo. And Bigfoot would have to be a really good blender hider to basically disappear into these surroundings. Bigfoot's coat would also very likely change color based on the season.
Yes, I think so, too. A lot of, especially in that part of the world, a lot of mammals will have their winter and summer coats, and a lot of those do change. So I think our Bigfoots might even have evolved stripes, which would be really cool to see, with the breaking of its pattern. To the point earlier about the tigers, if you've never seen it, it's very apparent to us what a tiger looks like, but just Google tiger the way a deer sees it, or a black and white tiger, and seeing the tiger against a green background with our color-seeing eyes, and then seeing it against a background with the eyes that a deer has, you can't fucking see it. It's incredible.
It is so hard to spot.
Yeah.
Is some multicellular life form with stripes, huge razor-sharp teeth about 11 foot long and of the genus Felis horribilis, what we doctors in fact call a tiger.
Despite all the facts that, you know, we have now brought up and the facts that many other journals have brought up about the problems associated with Bigfoot, it doesn't stop people from believing that Bigfoot is real. Now, one of the things that has come out of all this is people that regularly collect hair. Oftentimes we'll put it up on a mantelpiece or stick it in a bag and they go, I found this in the woods. It can only be proof that this is Bigfoot's hair.
Or, so, or braid it and smell it at night.
Oh, ew.
I definitely do that.
So a research team out of Oxford University, led by geneticist Brian Sykes, back in, I believe it was 2014, basically focused on collecting various hair samples that people believed had been attributed to Bigfoot. So they focused on 37 samples was sort of the end that they kind of screened it down to, just because a number of the samples were damaged or there was no viable DNA. But they got 37. They were like, hey, this is usable. Of those, 7 of the samples didn't yield enough DNA for identification. Of the 30 that they were actually able to sequence, all matched known sequences. So they found that the hairs belonged to various bear species. 4 were from horses, 4 were from wolves or dogs, 1 was a perfect match to human hair,
all right,
and the others came from cows, raccoons, deers, and even porcupine. However, really interesting, 2 samples from India and Bhutan matched polar bear DNA, a surprising finding that Sykes is following up on to determine whether or not some Himalayan bears are hybrid species with polar bears. So they've actually opened
up. That's really fucking cool. Right?
Is that not really cool that people submitted their Bigfoot hair and they were like, you're going to prove it's Bigfoot. And the geneticist comes back and he's like, I've got some really interesting stuff for you. And they're like, And it's like, so we now think that polar bears might actually be a cross with some Himalayan bears, explaining a common genetic ancestry. And they're like, whoa, where's my Bigfoot in all this? And it's like, no, we're past your Bigfoot. We weren't that interested in it.
Uninteresting.
But Himalayan bears.
We've tricked you.
Have you thought about Himalayan bears before?
Are you sure they didn't actually collect the sample from Hawaii? Because I've seen the documentary Lost and there was a polar bear in those woods.
I do want to know the percentage of absolutely juvenile pranksters that sent in pubic hair. Adam's raising his hand.
I will say that I found one of the best was a man in Utah discovered what he thought was a fossilized Bigfoot skull in 2013. A local paleontologist confirmed that the skull was simply an oddly shaped weathered rock.
So I'm going to squatch my way over to my section. Squatchers. She squatchers. Squatch hers. Squatch trackers. Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. These are the groups who are self-proclaimed Bigfoot hunters, trackers, and expert cryptozoologists. I wanted to dedicate my story section to this because it is just too good not to. before you cry fringe, I'm going to show you some stats first. So Civic Science published data showing that 41% of U.S. adults ascribe to at least one of seven common conspiracy theories. Now, more than one in 10 American adults believe that Bigfoot is a real living creature. So that's about 11 to 14% of Americans believe this.
All
right.
And just as Scots are more likely to believe in the Loch Ness Monster than Englanders, Americans are more likely to believe in Bigfoot than Canadians. So, Dave, your people are at least free from from this conspiracy. But this will be relevant later.
I mean, we have a mythical creature that lives here that's called the Quebecois, but I'm pretty sure they don't exist. Pretty sure.
They think everybody else doesn't exist. So
yeah, actually, that is the way, unfortunately, things are going.
Yeah, there's even an article I found titled "More People Believe in Bigfoot Than They Believe in Hillary Clinton." So take that. What you will. UC Berkeley article written by Chrissy Elliott is what I'm going to be quoting most today. And it is, so why do people believe in Bigfoot anyways? And I kind of wanted to talk about why people go down this cryptid rabbit hole.
It's a good question, because the fuck?
So there's four main reasons. Reason one, they think they saw a Sasquatch and they want to prove to themselves and the world that they are not crazy. So people want a belief system that is comprehensive and consistent. And if something in our belief system is inconsistent, we get cognitive dissonance and it bugs us. Tuck Thompson, a UC Berkeley grad and professor of anthropology and communication at USC, says. To finish this quote, he says, because of this, we try to make sense of the seemingly fantastical by weaving it into our currently held perspective. And it makes sense, right? We want to explain the unexplainable. It's human nature to try to fill in the blanks.
I feel like it's similar logic to the people that see aliens or that really, really make a case for having seen a I hesitate to say UFO because if it's a flying object, you don't know what it is. That's a UFO. It just means unidentified flying object. But people that think they saw aliens, I think, are very similar in their why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's actually, so I wanted to talk about, and the article mentions Grover Krantz. Have you guys ever heard that name?
No.
It sounds super familiar to me.
Yeah, he was a Cal grad and the first well-respected anthropologist to come out in support of the search for Sasquatch. Yeah. He never encountered Bigfoot himself. He died back in 2002. But his review of the evidence presented led him to believe that the creature was real, and he risked his entire career as a professor to accommodate his belief in the creature, including being turned down for promotions, grants, and nearly getting fired.
Wow. I mean, kudos if you're basing it all on the evidence and the evidence is convincing enough to you, like, you're doing your duty as a scientist to try to follow up on that evidence.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I feel like an interesting note about him was after his death, an editor at NPR, actually, her name is Laura Krantz, saw his obituary in the Washington Post and realized that Grover was her cousin. So she spent a year documenting his life work and made a podcast all out of it called Wild Thing. And it's about the relationship between science and society. And through her reporting for the podcast, she came to understand the search for Sasquatch spoke to an important questions about human evolution, conspiracy theories, and the human connection to the natural world.
Hmm.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Reason number two, lack of proof doesn't disprove that Bigfoot exists, so it's hard to declare with certainty that Bigfoot is fake. So what keeps legends alive is actually the lack of proof. Lynn McNeil, Cal grad, folklore professor, and special guest of the reality TV show Finding Bigfoot, says, because mysteries appeal to the natural curiosity inherent in human beings. The act of entertaining legends allows people to expand their minds and challenge traditional perceptions. But more importantly here, I wanted to talk about scientific confirmation bias, and I wanted to throw to Adam to explain what confirmation bias is in science.
Confirmation bias is where you make a confirmation based off of an inherent bias that you have around whatever you're looking at. That is why it's really, really important to trust what the data is showing you and try to look at it in a way that is very neutral. If you are going out into the woods expecting to find Bigfoot tracks and you see some tracks and the first thing you do is say, these are Bigfoot tracks, that is confirmation bias. You are just confirming what you're looking for and not looking at any of the other possibilities that it could be.
So it's kind of like looking at information with blinders on, so to speak.
Exactly. And blinders that are specifically shaped in Bigfoot track shaped, oculars.
Could it be that I have become so disconnected from how the children think these days? No, it is the children that are wrong.
It is the whole world that is incorrect.
Exactly.
Yeah, so on that note, reason three is their tribe or group believes in Sasquatch, so it would be weird if they didn't. Studies show that a person is more likely to believe in fringe or paranormal ideas if they're a West Coast resident in the U.S., with California being largely known as Bigfoot country.
That makes sense.
Really?
Yeah, there's been, according to the BFRO, which is the Bigfoot Research Organization, that is basically a compiled data list of all sightings and all things Bigfoot. There's been over 430 sightings reported in the state since the 1940s. And as per our statistic earlier about Americans believing more than Canadians, that's what it is. It's group dynamics, right? We have the tradition of seeing Bigfoot, especially in California. So where are all the Bigfoot sightings and where do more people believe? In that area. Just as I said, examples with the Loch Ness Monster, more people from Scotland are likely to believe than they are in England. More than half of Icelanders believe in the Icelandic hidden elf people called, and I'm going to mispronounce this, the Huldufólk.
Huldufólk.
To the extent that they are building, the building projects are often changed or waylaid so as not to disturb rocks where they are assumed to live.
Wow.
Which I love. What a delightful way to look at the world.
I mean, this would explain why Sam keeps getting caught up in the Norwegian troll hunts.
It's just their culture. We just don't get it.
Yeah.
It's human psychology to want to be included, to not want to stand out from the group. I mean, there's tons of, psychological experiments and studies that have shown this. So this is kind of no exception.
Guys, I think I figured it out. I know how to save the North American wilderness. Now, the people that tend to believe in Bigfoot, from my experience, I don't know if this is 100% true. Maybe there's some statistics out there. I believe are also tend to be of a conservative bent in their political thinking. If we can get these people to think that if they save the forests and they stop the oil companies, it will be preserving Bigfoot habitat. Maybe it can mobilize the politicians to stop letting oil companies destroy all this land because we need to save it as a Bigfoot preserve. Look at Iceland. They didn't want to build a road because it would destroy a rock that was being used by the Huldufólk. Look at these enormous tracts of wilderness. These small, fragile Bigfoot populations need them. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. If you are a liberal Bigfoot believer, I apologize. This is just my experience, like I said.
On that note, reason four, and probably the saddest reason, believing in Bigfoot keeps hope alive that people can be self-sustaining and that humans have not totally destroyed the environment beyond repair.
That's awful.
Super depressing. So it's both exciting and comforting for people to think that a somewhat intelligent bipedal hominid could live undetected and free in the wilderness, says McNeil. Lynn McNeil. Okay. Sorry, I'm going to reread that. It's both exciting and comforting for people to think that a somewhat intelligent bipedal hominid could live undetected and free in the wilderness, says Lynn McNeil, the folklore professor and guest on the Finding Bigfoot show, says. People like to entertain the idea of doing that themselves. Robert Pyle, a journalist who immersed himself in the lives of scientists, hunters, and all the others who are obsessed with the search for Bigfoot, wrote in his book Where Bigfoot Walks, quote, "These guys don't want to find Bigfoot. They want to be Bigfoot." So I think it's a mix of wanting to believe in the existence that something can be untouched. You know, maybe it's an excuse. Maybe it's coping. Maybe it's a bit of hope that humans haven't impacted everything.
Aw. I knew a guy who used to go with his dad every year into the wilderness to go looking for Bigfoot. And looking back on it, you're right. If I want to look at it as just a father-son bonding exercise that didn't involve rifles and hunting, just literally a camera and watching tracks, maybe I should be encouraging more Bigfoot watch.
Related to that, I have a theory on a reason five why Bigfoot hunters or Bigfoot believers are still out there.
Is it because they saw Adam wandering through the woods nude at night and they were like, that is clearly only Bigfoot. There could be nothing else that is.
I would obviously never walk through the woods at night. That's when the Blair Witch gets you. You told us this.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
But related to hunting, I think that especially in North America, toxic masculinity is such a problem. It is more acceptable to go out in the woods with your friends who also happen to be men. And if you're a male Squatch hunter, I should say, to go out with your friends in the woods chasing a most likely imaginary hominid than it is to just have an emotional relationship with one another and spend time with one another.
You know, there's an old joke that says golf was invented because men were too scared to ask for each other. Golf was invented because men were too scared to ask each other to go on a long walk.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, think about these Finding Bigfoot shows. I haven't seen them, but I've seen the memes of just these dudes, all these bros out in the woods, literally yelling at Bigfoot, like, come on, bro, come on, show yourself. It's the same as the ghost hunters. Like, they just bros who want an excuse to spend time with each other without being looked at as weird by their friends. And it's less weird to do this than to just have an emotional relationship with a platonic emotional relationship with your male friend. Thank you for coming to my second TED Talk.
Friend, me nice.
Matt?
Matt. He wants to put his fingers in my mouth, Matt.
Bro, just let him do it. He's establishing dominance.
I think I know the answer to this part as well, but would we recommend this movie?
No.
or Libby, I guess, no.
If I got together with a group of friends and had a couple of beers and we wanted a stupid movie to make fun of, but also simultaneously got a scare response every once in a while... maybe, but generally speaking, no. My wife left halfway through this because she was like, this is dumb, I'm going to bed.
Woman of taste.
So picky. I think I would, with the caveat that there would be caveats attached to it. Like, do you like found footage? You don't watch this movie. You do? Okay, check it out. It's worth a watch, in my opinion. But I would also add on that they should instead watch Willow Creek, Bobcat Goldthwait's Bigfoot movie from, I believe it was 2014, which I think is a much better, not only found footage movie, but a much better Bigfoot movie. And do we feel bad for our poor Sasquatch that Libby had a very heart-wrenching summary for at the beginning of this podcast for us?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. The distraught, angry, unclear, clearly broken up with its baby. I mean, it's dragging dead bodies up there to try and like show them what it's done to it, that potentially is in a situation of not being able to reproduce frequently if it is populations are low in numbers. But yeah, I definitely feel bad for the, I mean, don't walk your kids at night on the road. Just throwing that out there. You have a whole woods to walk in. But still, I shouldn't be blaming the parent for the death of their kid.
Yeah. I mean, I feel bad for it. I'm making some logic leaps and assuming that since it is a primate in nature, that it would want to be at least around others of its kind, particularly in a distraught situation. And there's none to be found. So I know Adam had some theories on that, but it just really leads me to believe personally that it is one of the last of its kind. And the wailing that you hear in the night, that you recognize later once you kind of know that it's the kid that has died. The movie portrays it as pain from being potentially hit by the car, but then after the fact, you now see it as the mourning cries of its dead child. That's heartbreaking.
I didn't even think about that. I completely forgot about it.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Very heartbreaking. Yeah, I definitely feel bad for this thing, this creature. It's obviously intelligent. It is going through some shit. And these people are so reprehensible. I would have absolutely killed Beardy McPukeface at the very end, too. His uncle did nothing wrong. And he completely left his uncle, too.
Yeah.
This guy came into the woods to save your ass, going through who knows how much trouble after you stole from him and got all your friends killed. And you just leave him the second there's a sign of trouble? Go fuck yourself.
Dude. One of the guys...
Yeah, I feel bad for the Bigfoot.
One of the guys totally forgets about his friend's broken legs and sits down on them accidentally in the camper and then gets up and is like, oh, sorry, bro, sorry.
My bad, bro.
Yeah. So, next week we'll be staying in the realm of fantastical creatures and going with Season 3's Love, Death, and Robots, specifically Episode 2, Bad Traveling, for a rather terrifying... isopod? Decapod? We'll see.
And for those
for that next week.
And for those who don't know what Love, Death, and Robots is, it is episodic, so you do not have to watch the entire season of the show to watch this episode. So feel free to just watch that episode if you want to stay in line with watching as we do our episodes. It's very poorly said.
That was very concise. Thank you for that. Yeah, episode 2 of season 3 of Love, Death, and Robots. Just watch that one. Watch the whole thing if you want. I would recommend watching season 1 because it's great. But specifically, episode 2, season 3. We'll see you there next week. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
And Bigfoot is as well. Bye!
There's no credible documented cases of a Sasquatch attack.
Shut up about a Sasquatch.
It's okay. There's nothing out here.